A beautiful Wednesday. Hope you're enjoying it out there. It's fantastic outside. And we're buried in a basement, but I'm not complaining because it is 5 p.m.
You sound like you're complaining.
No, I'm happy to be here. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Wednesday edition of American Hit Radio. Tom Ryan here with me, Heidi Morales Ryan, my lovely and immensely talented wife.
Oh, wow. You must want something.
More about that later. But we're going to be bringing you music from the year 1973 once again. Yeah, time to get back to 73. We were off of it for a while, covered a bunch of other years, and I went back to look at my list of things that I wanted to cover. And we could be on 73 for really maybe the rest of the year. There's a ton of like immensely classic albums that we need to cover from this period. For this show, I decided to actually start it off by looking at a fairly mixed bag of albums. Some of them classic, some of them maybe not quite so classic. You know, I mean, as much as I rave about popular music in the year 1973, you could tell that a sort of dismaying trend was beginning to become apparent on the pop charts. A lot of the classic acts that had been around since the mid to late 60s, now making albums, looked like they were beginning to show signs of, you know, wear. like they were getting tired, or things were changing, causing them to the material to suffer, to lose some of its bite. So we're going to look at various aspects of 1973, keeping that in mind. The first album up that I want to cover is by the Allman Brothers Band, which came out, like I said, just about 40 years ago, in the late summer of 1973. Up until this point in their career, they released two absolutely brilliant studio albums that had subsequently been combined into one double album called Beginnings. But at first when they were coming out, they were like, they only sold, you know, reasonably well, but nothing remarkable. But it was the live album, Live at Fillmore East, that changed everything, because still to this day, considered by many, including me, as perhaps the single best live rock and roll album ever made. So that's a huge statement to make, but that album really is that good. Then, of course, the lead guitarist, Duane Allman, was killed in a motorcycle accident. Subsequent to that, Barry Oakley, the band's bass player, also died almost uncannily to in almost the same spot.
That's crazy.
Also in a motorcycle accident.
Obviously, and a dangerous intersection.
Yeah, it's a horrible, you know, horrible thing to think. And obviously, and what this did to the band, it devastated everybody. The album Eat a Peach came out because it was a peach truck that had actually killed Duane. That's right. Where that came from. And that double album featured, I'd say 70% of that album was taken from the exact same shows as the live from Fillmore East album. So that really, that one weekend of shows pretty much was the highlight of the Allman Brothers' career. You could say that their entire career rested upon what happened at the Fillmore East that weekend, because two double albums back-to-back consisted almost exclusively or exclusively of material from those shows. Well, now they had to recover if they were going to go on. So the first thing they needed was a new bass player. They brought in a new bass player named Lamar Williams. And Duane Allman being virtually irreplaceable, they actually brought in a piano player to change their sound. And Chuck Lavelle is the guy who came aboard. And the resulting album, called Brothers and Sisters, is really a good record. A little bit commercial, maybe more than a little bit commercial, compared to what we were used to. The song Ramblin' Man was all over the radio in 1973, for better or worse. Probably the type of song that you might have enjoyed the first 200 or 300 times you heard it, and then kind of really wished you to never hear it again. That's kind of what happened with me. But with that, the other track, of course, that was off of that album that got a tremendous amount of airplay was Jessica, the instrumental song, which is also like used as a theme song for that car show from England right now. That's them using Jessica by the Allman Brothers. You know that show, those three guys that sit around and they talk about race cars and they race them on the track. I forget the name of that show.
Oh, yeah, the on BBC America.
Yeah, it's a BBC show. Anyway,
I forget.
So you hear that really just virtually every day if you ever watch the BBC TV shows regarding that. But the other songs in the album just didn't get that much airplay, and some of the best songs were the others. So we'll play one track from this album that I don't think you hear on the radio very much. It's actually my favorite song on the album, Brothers and Sisters. This is called Come and Go Blues. composition by Greg Allman right there on that track. The band sunk into a pretty deep funk after this album came out. Their career just seemed to... There were so many things that were going wrong, not just, you know, with the deaths of the two players, but drug issues and jail.
Sign of the times.
And Greg having to testify against people who were employed by the band. And so internal squabbles and fighting began to go on. It got really ugly and bad for a while. So the Allman Brothers sort of became irrelevant right after this album was released, or less relevant, I suppose, is the best way to put it. Meanwhile, another band came out of the South that's essentially redefined what Southern rock was the second that they appeared. Lynyrd Skynyrd released their debut album at about the exact same time as Brothers and Sisters came out. And what they basically did was they added sort of a punky hard rock feel to Southern rock that was, you know, with an emphasis more on like the rocking side of it rather than the blues element. It's hard to say really which band would more adequately represent the music of the Southern United States. But by the time that the Skynyrd album came out, they won hands down, it seemed. Everybody was more or less, you know, beginning to pick up on what Skynyrd was about. Now, this is the album. The first album that came out was called Pronounced Lynyrd Skynyrd. It was their debut album. This is the album that actually ended with Freebird. And you want to talk about a song that redefined, you know, a genre. Of course, also overplayed. I'm going to avoid playing that simply because I don't think my friends would allow me to play it, but I would never live it down. But I know that in 1976, I was in bands that played that track, and it was always, you know, awesome to watch the audiences react to it. And there was a lot of, again, this is another album that had a lot of good songs on it that weren't as well known as Freebird or Gimme Three Steps, which are the two, I think, that have been culled from the album most often. So let's hear a couple of songs from the first Lynyrd Skynyrd album that I think define it as well as any of those other songs that we just don't hear quite as often, including this, the opening track called I Ain't the One.
One, two, three. We'll be right back.
got my pistols in my pocket, boys. I'm Alabama bound. I've got my pistols in my pocket, boys. I'm Alabama bound. Well, I'm not looking for no trouble, but nobody dogs me round. Now, well, I'm going to fetch my woman, people. Try, should this, here I come. Oh, well, I'm going to fetch my woman, people. Try, should this, here I come. She was raised up on that cornbread. I know that woman, give me some. Give me some, baby. Alabama people, don't you try to dog him round. Now in the kids, Alabama people, don't you try to dog him round. Cause if you people cause me trouble, Lord, I got to put you in the ground.
The before and after of Southern rock right there, with the Allman Brothers leading off the show, and two from Leonard Skinner from the album called Pronounced Leonard Skinner. If you didn't know, that story was actually named, I believe, after their gym instructor, who was Leonard Skinner, and probably in a stoned reverie, they just thought it was really funny to call him Leonard Skinner and ended up naming the band that. Anyway, we heard I Ain't the One and Mississippi Kid there back to back. Very easy album to like, especially in the early 70s when that had come out. Now, while Southern rock was just going through this developmental phase and becoming fairly huge, at the same time, things were changing a lot on the R&B market. Obviously, Motown had changed drastically, led primarily by Stevie Wonder and Marvin Gaye, moving Motown toward a more progressive sense. Like a lot, for example, just the fact that they were able to make good cohesive albums was a huge change in terms of what Motown was about. And Stevie Wonder in particular was on a roll. His previous album from 1972 was Talking Book, which was just a stunning, perfect album, really, followed by this album in 1973 called Inner Visions, another stunning, virtually perfect album, which was then followed the following year by Fulfilling This's first finale, yet another five-star perfect album. So, you know, Stevie was just about as creative as he possibly could be, and this is him right in the middle of that creative phase. Now, of course, on this album, on Inner Visions, this is the album that had Living for the City, a song speaking of Mississippi, as Lynyrd Skynyrd was just singing about a kid from Mississippi coming to New York and finding that, you know, big city, just like he pictured it, had a few things in store for him. And it's all the more power to Stevie Wonder to be able to write songs on an album where he talks about really a lot of depressing subjects, about people being taken advantage of in the city, about societal ills, you know, drugs, etc. The failure of the 60s dream to deliver at all, political issues and ethics and how the politicians take advantage of people. You put all this on a record and you think, oh, this is going to be a pretty depressing affair. Instead, you end up with songs like Living for the City and Higher Ground, which are fantastic songs. And I'm just not going to play them here again because I'm trying to avoid the obvious singles. And because when I do cover singles from 73, you can be sure I will be playing them on a single show. So let's pull out two album tracks again. We can maybe play two back to back. The first one is a song that is really a cautionary tale about how the 60s ideology led by certain drug intake, which was actually considered to be a way of mind expansion, had turned around and had become a threat more than a promise. So, which is the meaning of the first song, Too High. The second track, He's Mr. Know-It-All, is really very simply just Stevie's opinion of then President Richard Nixon. So here's both of those tracks from the album Inner Visions.
She's a girl in a dream. She sees a four-eyed cartoon monster on the TV screen. She takes another puff and says it's a crazy scene. That red is green. She's a tangerine. I'm too high, I'm too high, but it left the ground. I'm too high, I'm too high, I hope I never ever come down. She's a girl in her life, but her world's a superficial paradise. She had a chance to make it big more than once or twice, but no dice, she wasn't very nice. We'll be right back.
I get into the sky. Do what? I'm so high, I feel like I'm about to die. She's good to the past. I guess that I got through her at last. Did you hear the news about the girl today? She passed away. What did a friend say? They said she's too high, too high. We can't handle just don't give a care, no, he's
perhaps one of the best albums of 1973. Not perhaps, definitely one of the best albums of 1973. I think it won the Grammy for Album of the Year.
Usually Stevie Wonder, the kiss of death for...
It wasn't for Stevie. In fact, he was like getting that every year and deserving it. This is when the Grammys actually were giving the awards out to deserving albums. Now, I had mentioned that there was an awful lot of artists who seemed to be like losing their groove, their mojo, so to speak, as 1973 was wearing on. And one of those guys actually was Van Morrison. He's coming off of this huge run of success with Astral Weeks, mm-hmm. Into Moondance, his band and street choir, Tupelo Honey, St. Dominic's Preview. That's quite a run, mm-hmm. of classic, fantastic albums.
And then what happened?
And then he releases this album, which was called Hard Knows the Highway, which was, like, I don't know, instantly ignored. And it's weird because it's one of those records that I totally am guilty of ignoring when it came out. I don't even remember the cover. And it wasn't until maybe a decade or two later, when I was collecting all the Van stuff that I didn't already own, that I had seen this album. And I'm looking at the cover and thinking, is this real? Is this, maybe this is a, you know, when things get re-released and they put bad covers on them?
Uh-huh.
I thought that's what this was, because it was like a really bad cartoon drawing that didn't seem as though it really conveyed anything that had resembled what Van Morrison's music would be like. And the album itself was a little bit, what's the word? It was a lot of variety on the record. Some of it was like the hit, quote unquote hit, was the song Warm Love, which was not particularly great. He had a version of It's Not Easy Being Green on side two of the record, which was also a sign of like really?
Okay.
You know? But there were other things on there that was really, I considered to be some of the best stuff he's ever done. And I pulled two of those songs to play back to back because, like I said, you know, interspersed with stuff that you would think was definitely a sign of Van Morrison, of his decline, were these two songs that really showed that he was as strong as ever. So I want to play the title song called Hard Knows the Highway and segue that into a great, great, great song called The Great Deception. Listen to how he basically pokes fun at Frank Sinatra in that tune in the lyrics.
Take the first takes. Ain't that some interpretation? When Sinatra sings against Nelson Riddle strings and then takes a vacation, seeing some hard time, drawn some fast. Hard knows the highway. I was torn down at the dad's place. I shaved head at the organ, but I wasn't half as bad as it was. Oh no, Belfast and Boston. Seen some hard times, drawn some fine lines. No time for to shine. Hard knows the highway. Your mouth is, then we can get something going. In order to win, you must be prepared to lose sometime. and leave one or two cards showing. Seen some hard time, drawn some bad lines. No time for you, shine. And heart knows the highway. Further on up the road, further on up the road. It may not be today. It may be tomorrow. So if you live for today, you gotta keep in mind. Maybe tomorrow. Yes. Further on up the road. Further on up, 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 further on up the road. This may have the hard nose. It'll hard nose.
And they thought
it was rather quaint. Well, you know, it's no use to heat it. And you know, no use to think about it. But when you start to think about it, you don't need it. Have you ever heard about the great Hollywood motion picture acting? Do more than they did. And the newspapers didn't cover the story. They just decided to keep it hid. And somebody started saying it was an inside joke. Whatever happened to him? Last time they saw him down on the bar, with his lip hanging off an old rusty bottle of gin. Have you ever heard about the so-called hippies down on the far side on the track? They take the eyeballs straight out of your head. I say, son, kid, do you want your eyeballs back? Did you ever see the people with the teardrops in their eyes? Just can't stand it no how. Living in this world of lies. Did you ever hear about the Great Deception? Well, the plastic revolutionaries take the money and run. Have you ever been down to Love City? Well, they rob you with a smile instead of a gun. Have you ever heard about the Great Deception?
You can say what you want to about Hard Knows the Highway, or maybe you wouldn't say anything at all because you might not have heard it. But those two songs are two of the most powerful things a band had ever released, I think. Incredibly, you know, very damning songs. You know, he's naming names in some instances, and you know, basically, and the way that he basically tears into the music industry and what it's done to him, you know, doesn't it make you want to not even bother at all?
Mm-hmm.
And then his take on the hippies again, it's sort of like Stevie Wonder. It's like you're coming at it after the fact, and Stevie Wonder was singing actually with some sort of optimism about how society was collapsing. Not a lot of optimism in Van's image when he basically takes the hippies to task for losing their sense of ideology, etc., on that album. Like I said, the album itself is inconsistent, but the good stuff is quite excellent. Now, that album was called Hard Knows the Highway. The other band that I think fits very neatly into this setup that I'm trying to make about artists' decline is the Rolling Stones. In 1973, they released Goat's Head Soup, which was probably the worst album that they had released since the live album that they released in 1966. Maybe the worst studio album of their career up until this point of new material. I mean, they're coming off of what had to be one of the most successful runs of any rock and roll band in the history of music. I mean, topped really only by the Beatles. So it's certainly, you know, bands are entitled. And again, like with the other examples, this album had a great hit. Angie was on this album, which was getting a ton of airplay. The problem with the record, in my mind, coming as it did after Exile on Main Street, which was a double album, very muddy, very dark, but incredibly intense, this album was incredibly clean, especially when compared to Exile. I mean, you can actually hear the vocals on this record, which is actually That's much funny. To the record's detriment.
Oh.
You know, when Mick Jagger sounds, you know, cleanliness doesn't suit the Stones. When you're singing explicitly about drugs and devils and depravity, a little bit of mud makes it more believable, makes it darker. So when they sing things like Dancing with Mr. D and the production is just, you know, sharp as a tack, the song loses its edge. It just doesn't sound as heavy. Or when they sing Star, Star, which was actually, you know, a cleaned up version of what they were really singing because it had, you know, a pretty intense swear word in the title of the song. It's the way that the album ended. It would have been better if it was muddier because it would have been even more scary. But as it is, the album was okay. It had some decent stuff on it. It had a lot of filler on it. It's like the song Winter, which just sort of kind of went nowhere. But I picked two tracks that I think sort of represent the, I guess, the better side of the mediocrity of what the album Goat's Head Soup represented. Here are those two tracks. And the first is called Do-Do-Do-Do-Do. Good title there. And followed by Silver Train.
Thank you.
right, then. There it is. We just stayed up another hour of your life. Hopefully put it to good use, playing a bunch of tracks from 1973. We'll be back next week. We'll do more of this because there's so many truly classic albums that we need to cover. We'll take a look at those, including things like The Who's Quadrophenia. It is just one among them. The New York Dolls debut album. There's stuff that's fabulous that I love. So we'll get to that. Meanwhile, we'll just leave you with another track from Marvin Gaye's release from the late summer of 73, a track called Come Get to This that's off of the album Let's Get It On. Thanks, everybody, and I hope you can join us on Friday as we continue our How Music Changed series looking at the Rolling Stones. See you then. Bye.